Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Energy careers. They're among the, well, pardon the pun, hottest careers, which are actually hot and which are not. But are smart careers, under-the-radar careers that maybe might be wise choices? What are the trends in energy? We keep hearing about solar relentlessly, probably to make us vomititious at this point, how we've heard it so much. Not to make us, but it makes us. We're kind of tired of hearing of it. Hydrogen fuel cells, cleaner coal, or is that an oxymoron? That's being snarky. There is cleaner coal, certainly. Nuclear. Or are we facing Fukushima with if we go more nuclear? Smart grid. Everybody seems to like smart grid. Who could be against efficient timed use of energy, distributed energy when it's needed? Robotics. All of the above? Well, before I go any further, I want to thank a listener, Jim Iyer. He enlightened me on the enormous range of options that now exist in the energy space and for recommending my guest. That guest, Merwin Brown. Merwin's been director of business planning for PG&E, manager at two national energy laboratories, including the National Renewable Energy Lab in Colorado, and currently a co-director of electric grid research for the California Institute for Energy and the Environment at the University of California, Berkeley. In all, he's had over 40 years of experience with the electric and natural gas utility industry, mostly managing technology research and development and business and strategic planning. He's got a PhD in nuclear engineering. Merwin Brown, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you.
So let's start with trends. The media, pretty much with one voice, is telling us that fossil fuels are not only the Antichrist, but they're on the way out. Fracking is an environmental disaster. Peak oil means we're soon going to be bereft. Nuclear is too dangerous. What the media is telling us that the answer is mainly solar and wind, maybe some natural gas in the mix. Is the broader truth that fossil fuels indeed need to be phased out as rapidly as possible, as President Obama is proposing?
Oh, well, that's a tough question. If you accept the science on the climate change issue and the trouble that that portends for us, then we need to be starting to get off anything that contributes to that problem, such as adding more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. And so that is a movement that's going on around the world. In the United States, California has been leading the way in trying to reduce the amount of carbon dioxides that are emitted in particularly producing electricity for our consumption.
You know, just before I let you go on, you said it's very interesting. Most of the, you know, I read the New York Times, and they say that, you know, and many of the other major media say, the science decided. And yet the very first words out of your mouth were, if you buy the science, is, from your perspective, and, you know, you've got a pretty wide perspective, but you're just one person, you know, no one person has a monopoly answer on this. To what extent, you know, when somebody doesn't accept the science, they're called deniers, like akin to Holocaust deniers. How settled, in your judgment, is the science that and that global warming and or climate change is largely anthropogenic, that we, in fact, are causing global warming and we should be stopping it? How settled is that science from your perspective?
Well, from a scientist's point of view, I always leave a little room for skepticism because we should always be questioning the science that's being done. Errors do get made. But there has been a lot of work done in this area, mm-hmm. and there is some definite logic behind the science principle, which is carbon dioxide gas, and there are other elements in the atmosphere that do produce this greenhouse effect where the light from the sun can come in, it gets hit on by the absorbed by the earth and re-emitted as thermal radiation, and that gets trapped by these various kinds of chemicals in the atmosphere and causes this heating effect.
That's theory. I want to hear about empiricism and models. Theory is very important. It's certainly part of the equation.
Yes, and therefore the measurements are I think, probably reasonably good. And the issue is there is so much data and so much that needs to be done with it, you get into the modeling, and that's where the big question lies.
Exactly what I wanted to ask about. How good is the modeling? You know, when I was in graduate school, we weren't talking about environment, but it was always garbage in, garbage out. Depending upon how good the data is that you're putting in and how long in the future you're predicting and how good the multiple regression equations are, your accuracy is good or bad. How accurate have the models that have been forecasting, now they've been forecasting this for two decades, how accurate regarding both climate change and global warming have the consensus models been?
I can personally address the accuracy. I'm not very much steeped in that particular area. I think the important thing that comes out of it is that the higher order information, the trends that are indicated are probably pretty acceptable. There's a high likelihood that those are in the right direction. When you get into the very specifics, that's when it gets more questionable. So I guess you asked me the question personally. Again, with a bit of always some skepticism in place, I accept for the most part that we've got a problem.
Okay, and so given that, then we have the standard answer is alternative energy, low carbon, you know, reduced carbon footprint, solar, wind, hydroelectric, maybe nuclear. Is that, from where you sit, is that where, from a job, remember this show is about career and jobs, from a career and jobs perspective, you know, I've been hearing that in solar manufacturing, for example, in the United States is, you know, not just Solyndra, but in general is in the toilet because China makes the solar PV photovoltaic cells much more cheaply and et cetera. From a career perspective, is the future in alternative low carbon energy sources like solar, wind, maybe even cleaner coal and nuclear?
Having been in this business for this long, the movement to renewables started back in the 70s, mm-hmm. really, with the oil embargoes. And it's been up and down, up and down. Most recently, it seems to have taken off.
Right.
It seems to have reached that threshold that it takes to catch on. So I think the renewable industry is, at worst, or at least, it's going to be an additional resource that's going to happen, and it is happening. And so, indeed, there are jobs there. Will the jobs, for example, in fossil and nuclear go away? I don't think so very soon. Regardless of how badly we'd like to get off those fuels, or at least some people would like to, and maybe we almost need to, there's the problem of the legacy system that we're heavily dependent upon, a huge amount of investment in it, and frankly, our livelihoods, our wealth and well-being depend on this energy system that we developed. And to switch to something that totally gets off of the system we had before, maybe the best metaphor I can think of would be like stepping from one speeding train to another one. It's very risky if you don't do it right.
Yeah, you know, something that I know as a career counselor, you know, if my client is a superstar, he or she can do, you know, can follow the trend when everybody's, you know, can go in solar and it'll be fine. But if you're not a superstar, it is very tough to compete in a world where everybody believes that we're moving in this direction. So solar, everybody wants to get into solar and alternative energy. Whereas we know that even in President Obama's plan to reduce carbon emissions significantly by 2030, it still allows for a lot of carbon in the mix, a lot of oil and natural gas and cleaner coal. And so do you think it's crazy of me to be advising my clients, if they ideologically feel okay about it, to go and actually be contrarian? Because every single darn graduate from UC Berkeley or Stanford or whatever, there isn't one who says, oh, I'm really eager to get into the coal industry, or I'm really eager to work for Exxon or Chevron. They may do it holding their nose, but in general, everybody wants to work in alternative energy. From a pragmatic perspective, if I told my clients, if you can ideologically feel okay about it, you'd have a hell of an easier time getting good work if you're working for a Chevron than you are working for a First Solar.
Well, I haven't really experienced that personally, but I would say you're probably right. The established corporations hire a lot of people, and they have a lot of, if you will, different dimensions to them. The smaller startup companies have fewer opportunities. They require a lot of the people to have this kind of entrepreneurial spirit, to be committed, I think, to what they're doing in almost a mission-oriented kind of thing. Having said that, there's also some routine jobs in these startup companies, such as installing solar systems and all that. I guess another way to look at this, too, is that one of the excitements in the renewable area is that we're talking rapid growth of recent times. But on the other hand, you got to think in terms of you started off with something that was less than 1% of the total energy mix. Sure, rapid growth, but it's still just a few percentage points when you're at the end of the day, so to speak. So the majority of the jobs for a long time will probably still be in the more traditional areas. I would say that particularly in the utility business, but probably in all energy in general, I think we're on threshold of significant change. Change in business models, change in the way they earn money, a lot of changes in the relationship with the customer, a lot of changes in the technology they'll be using. So I think for anyone who wants to go to work in the energy business, that's probably the one reservation they ought to hold in their mind, is they're entering a very an industry that's in turmoil, particularly the electric industry. That can be good and bad depending on who you are and how well prepared you are. You know, a lot of people say chaos and churn provides opportunity, and I think there's a lot of truth in that. Provides excitement for others. It can be paralyzing fear in not knowing what's going to happen next. And I don't want to overstate it. There's going to be, again, a lot of momentum from the traditional approach that will still be there. But the trend, and on the margins, you're going to see a lot of change in this industry.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Merwin Brown. We're talking careers in energy, the present and future. We know that he who lives by the crystal ball often eats broken glass, but we're doing our best to not project too far in the future where things get really hazy, but trying to make some reasonable probabilistic predictions about both where the jobs are and as where, also just for from an intellectual curiosity perspective, where the future trends are. You say that that things are going to be very disruptive, that the utility industry specifically is going to change a great deal. Give me a kind of an eye-opening example of what likely changes will accrue in the utility industry and especially how that might affect jobs.
Okay. Well, one of them is technology. It's changing dramatically, and we don't have time to go into a lot of detail, but maybe two areas or three that I would highlight at the moment. One of them, as you mentioned, the smart grid. The smart grid is really all about applying sensors and communication of data, computers to do analysis, and then electronic control systems to make things happen. That's relatively new to this, to the electric industry. It's been used for a few decades now, but in a very small way. It's now accelerating rapidly, largely in part due to other changes that are going on in this system that's requiring something that has, if you will, capability beyond the human mind and ability to do things, and that's bringing in this computerized automated system.
So let me make that clear. I guess what we're talking about, when we're talking about smart grid, we're talking about what's called, you know, demand-adjusted energy release, so that, you know, depending upon which areas of the country are going to have experiencing high demand, that more energy would be released through those pipes, if you will, and where there's less, there would be less release, so that there is, you know, there was more, we could use capacity more efficiently. Is that a good summary?
No, because it's too short.
Great, go ahead.
It's too brief.
All right.
It doesn't cover the whole spectrum.
All right.
We're talking about everything in the value chain, from the generator of electricity, whether that generator is the more traditional central station or whether it's the more modern generator on your rooftop using solar photovoltaic systems to produce electricity. It covers that all the way to the delivery of the electricity to an ultimate customer and the use of that electricity. It's in all aspects.
What do you mean by that? What was the last phrase? Delivery? How is it? Delivery is what I thought I was talking about, and then you said use. How is that disruptive, to use the current term? How is that changing?
There's quite a few things changing. The one thing about it is the traditional system that's been around for 100 years and started with Tesla and Westinghouse back just before the beginning of the 20th century has been pretty much the model of large central power plants dumping power into a high voltage transmission line, going through what now is a network to the distribution system, which are generally radial lines, that is sort of single lines emanating out like branches from a tree, hooking up to the various customers to deliver electricity at a lower voltage. That's the traditional system. A number of things are happening. One of them is, and the other, and one of them I was going to mention that's a radical change, is the reliance of more and more renewables. What has changed about renewables, or the renewables, the change that renewables bring, is another fundamental change. For over 100 years, the generators that went into the electric grid had big rotating mass electric generators, and a lot of them had turbines. The grid was built to operate with that kind of inertia. They're fairly slow changing, and the grid came to rely on that. A lot of the new renewable generators are using power electronics, only available because the transistor was invented quite a few decades ago, that have almost no inertia, and they change instantaneously. The grid was not designed for that. And one of the answers to this is bringing in smarts to the grid to be able to maintain the stability. The grid is actually a fairly unstable device. We've had blackouts. I'm sure the listeners know about things like the big blackout in 2003 in the Northeast. The grid is fairly difficult to actually maintain and keep up and running. And as we bring more and more of these uncertainties, such as renewables or electric cars into the picture, it becomes a bigger and bigger challenge to keep that grid up and running.
Yeah.
And this is what's opening the door to bringing in all of these people who know something about how computers work, how you get information through sensors, how you store it, how you use it, how you analyze it.
Yeah, the problem I'm listening is I'm thinking about my listenership. My listeners here, from the calls that I get, I would say that 90% of them are not techies. They're word people, they're people people, they have college degrees, but they are not engineers, they are not computer programmers. Are they relegated to jobs as, HR and accountants maybe and receptionists, or are there jobs that, other than those obvious ones, in this really now ever more computer-centric and engineering-centric world that the utilities and energy will be involved in?
That one's going to be a bit difficult to answer. But in general, first of all, like the utilities, most of them are large companies, so they're going to require all of the skills that any company requires. The one thing that may be new for a lot of these people, whether they're accountants, tax people, or marketing people, is that they're going to be dealing with this uncertainty a lot more, and that probably means people who can understand how to see what changes are made, how customers are changing, so that they can change accordingly. But the kind of skills that be required will still need the traditional business skills, the human, human communication skills and management skills, that kind of thing.
I'm going to interrupt you just because
we're. By the way, I might mention in this area that I do see some rather, I think, big growth in is going to be customer relations. For almost 100 years, there really wasn't a customer as far as the utility was concerned. It was a meter. And they really didn't know much about how the customer used the electricity, didn't really need to know or care. They just need to know they got it and they got billed for it. That's changing. The customer is becoming more and more a practitioner, if you will. They're becoming more and more involved in making decisions about when to buy power, what kind of power, et cetera. That goes back to this demand response and control you were talking about. And that leads us back again to the gadgets. It leads us back to the things in the home that will allow, for example, the home to make decisions for the consumer as to how much to pay for electricity, when they're going to buy it, and that means determining when certain appliances work. It's becoming very complex, and I think we'll need to rely more and more upon these computerized technologies to make it happen.
Right.
But the companies involved are going to have to understand the consumers and start tailoring the service and the product as these customers start demanding different kinds of services.
How does it need to be different than, I mean, right now you can buy certainly, of course, thermostats that are you know, time sensitive. You can have these home control things to keep your lights on and off and whatever. What other kind? And I get, of course, I get these, you know, pieces of paper. It's ironic they're trying to save energy, but I'm getting. It seems like every month I get these pieces, these U.S. mail delivered envelopes that tell me how my energy use is compared to my neighbors and whatever. How are things going to evolve from there, in your judgment?
Yeah, you're seeing what I think is the tip of the iceberg, and it's going to take a while, in my opinion. And by the way, that's a concern I have, is over-marketing of these potential changes and the benefits. I'm concerned that people will be oversold and they think they should be showing up in the next year or so, and it won't. And yet the utilities are making all these investments in these smart technologies, and I'm concerned there'll be a backlash. And the reality is they have to make these investments, I think, to keep the lights on and prices in check. That's the condition we've gotten to in this country, or in the world for that matter. Now, to answer your question more directly, I think it will evolve, like a lot of other things have in our recent lives, where you'll start seeing more and more of these gadgets brought into the home, the homes more and more being able to network and handle these smart devices. I think the big factor will be when we're able to get systems that can help the customers make decisions. In other words, I don't think the most people are going to sit around and watch this thing on the screen that says, well, now's the time to turn your washer on because power is cheap and it's going to cost you less, or turn it off because it's getting expensive. That's going to get so complex, and people have, frankly, better things to do with their lives, that it's going to have to be taken over, I think, by computer systems that you control by sort of higher level messages, which is, hey, I want to be comfortable. I want my house to be this temperature. I'm willing to give something here at this time. But it's going to be very broad general instructions with, you know, keeping me comfortable at the same time save me money. You figure it out, computer, because I don't have the time or the ability. That's where I think we're heading. And it's probably 5 to 10 years off, although I have to admit I'm always being surprised by what that particular industry can do.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Merwin Brown. We're talking energy careers. He's currently co-director of energy grid research for the California Institute for Energy and the Environment at the University of California, Berkeley. You had earlier mentioned alternative energy cars, like electric cars or hydrogen fuel cell-powered cars. How much of that is an example of hype versus reality, at least over the next 5 or 10 years, especially as people are deciding what careers to pursue? Is that a niche that will likely burgeon, or is it going to be like the latest, you know, like ethanol that came and went?
That's another good one to ask. It's because it's another crystal ball one question. Again, my experience has been what you just said is, big move towards electric cars and hydrogen-powered cars, and then the interest dies out for various reasons because usually the crisis went away. There have been quite a bit of advances in the electric car. The batteries have gotten considerably better. The efficiency of the powertrains are better. So there's some hope that, like in the renewables area, we may have approached the threshold. And then the beauty, of course, is now with electric, for example, driven vehicles, you have a lot more flexibility in the kind of fuel you use. You're not stuck primarily with oil, which at first the big issue was in more recent, or you know, not too many years ago, was a concern about national security, still is. We're still maintaining a large military force to keep the oil coming in. And then there's now the carbon emissions issues. And electric cars would tend to take care of that. But there's also, I think, some other big issues. Until I think we get some kind of infrastructure in place, such as an ability to rapidly change out battery packs or rapidly change vehicles, the batteries in these things, I think a lot of the market would be limited to people who can go short distances. And at the moment, they're going to, I think, have to be able to be fairly wealthy in order to sort of buy the third car, if you will.
Right. Let me interrupt you. Toyota made a decision. I am not a brand loyal person except for Toyota, because I've had it my whole life. They all run 250 or 300,000 miles without problems. They're really an ethical company. I love that. And they made a decision last year. They had come out right away with the plug-in Prius hybrid. But they have decided, they say they're going to back off because they believe that ultimately, for a variety of reasons, not only the cost, but the fact that to provide the energy to fuel the darn thing requires, in general, until the old energy mix changes, requires fossil fuel energy in order to produce the energy to make the car go, and the cost is just prohibitive. They're putting their futures on hybrids. And they're very reliable. Hybrids are cheap and very reliable. What's your reaction to Toyota's decision?
I personally, by the way, I've done some work in electric cars earlier in my career, and back then I thought hybrid was the way to go. Maybe it's because I tend to be a somewhat conservative person and take the moderate route, but it seemed to me that easing into the electric industry was a much better route than trying to, again, step from one speeding train to another by switching dramatically. So to me, that is the potential answer, because then I can see if electric vehicles do catch on, and if the infrastructure gets in place, it can happen through a more incremental, gradual approach. And then one morning, so to speak, we wake up and said, hey, we've got an electric car industry. Most of our cars now are electric, and this is good. So that's kind of my opinion. But on the other hand, if I were running motor company and an auto company, I guess the one risk you're taking is what happens if they do take off big time and you're sitting there without a car to get into the market. Can you catch up? I can't answer those kinds of questions. But my personal belief is that I tend to go in that direction. I've also worked in the area of the hydrogen and fuel cell type cars. And I've had the same personal kind of feeling, which is rather than try to convert large masses of transportation to hydrogen and build the infrastructure it's going to take to fuel them, would be
all those hydrogen fuel cell gas stations. Yeah.
Take advantage of the current hydrogen business that we do have in this country, which is actually quite large for chemicals and things like that, and then ease into it. But there are a lot of people who said, no, we got to go to this directly or we'll never get there. Maybe they're right, I don't know, but my feeling is it's beating your head against the wall to try to bring those kind of changes in fast.
What about one of the things that for a while it was felt that nuclear energy was the answer because it is completely clean environmentally, to the air, to the water, et cetera. There is the storage problem, and then there was Fukushima, which was, of course, a nightmare. In every possible way. Do you have any opinion other than the general stargazer's opinion about the future, whether, again, from a career perspective, if somebody is thinking about where they want to spend their, we can't say 30 or 40 years because things change so much, but say, I want to go and get this degree in nuclear engineering, that was your degree originally, would you suggest somebody go get a degree in nuclear engineering today?
Yeah, there's two answers to two parts to that question, and I'm going to take this first one because I am a nuclear engineer. I went through school. I've done very little nuclear engineering. Done some. But I went into solar fairly rapidly, and then I went into the broader area of electric grid research and other forms like electric cars and things like this. And so my nuclear degree per se wasn't used much as a nuclear engineer. However, it prepared me for a tremendous versatility in technical fields, because it's an amazingly technical area. And a number of years ago, I know a university was thinking about putting in solar engineering and asked me my opinion about it, and I said, you know, I think you'd be better off getting a good fundamental degree in electrical or mechanical with some courses in solar, because you don't know where it's going. And in some ways, I faced that with nuclear. I made out okay because I had a tremendous education that I applied to other fields. And so I think if anyone goes into these kinds of decisions, I think they ought to go into it with that attitude is, well, I may not, if I take a solar degree, I may not turn out to be a solar engineer, but I want to learn what I can to be able to adapt and handle it. And if it turns out I am a solar engineer, then that's great. It worked out. So that's one comment I'd like to make. The other comment has to do with the future of nuclear. It's pretty complex, and if I look at it from a technical point of view, I personally don't have concern about the ultimate safety, because I think you can handle it. That doesn't mean people won't make stupid mistakes and problems won't happen, but there are problems no matter which way we go, and we don't have time to get into all of those. But whatever source you pick, there's going to be downsides to it. There always are trade-offs. What I personally think is happening is that nuclear at the moment requires large, long-term investments to build big power plants. That works today. It works best in countries that tend to have state-run and operated and financed power systems, like China and some of the other countries, where the government makes a decision, we're going to build a nuclear power plant, and they make it happen. When you're trying to build a nuclear power plant in a place like the U.S., where we have competitive markets for generators, usually the winner is the one who can build the power plant the fastest and get it up and operating and producing electricity as soon as possible. And generally, big power plants that require big construction schedules have a disadvantage in this country. So, yeah, I think nuclear is still surviving. Nuclear is being built in a lot of places in the world. But in places like the United States, it may make it, but it's tougher. And so I guess what I'm really saying is, if nuclear doesn't make it here, I think it's going to be more to do with the economics and the finance and the way our business is structured and our markets than it has to do with the technology and the safety issues. But you know, those will be part of the equation always, I think.
Anyway, well, thank you very much for being part of the equation and work with Marty Nemko. Merwin Brown is indeed co-director of electric grid research for the California Institute for Energy and Environment at the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks for giving me part of your Sunday, Merwin.
You're welcome, and thanks for giving me an opportunity.
My pleasure. Take care. Mm-hmm. Okay, and now we turn to you, my dear listeners. If you have a question or a comment, certainly doesn't have to be about energy-related careers, but any kind of career-related question, if you or someone you love has got a career conundrum, whether you're 16 or 76, whether you're a clerk, you're a nuclear engineer, or a president of a college, try to help you with whatever career malaise is besetting you. The phone number here for what I call a 3-minute workover, and I promise not to pummel you, is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while we're waiting for the calls to come in, I do collect every time I get a useful idea or had a good experience with a client or something that I think might benefit you, I write them down so that I can share them with you. So, one of the things we all know is that success in your job and in life is how well your brain works, how well you learn, how what you remember, how well you can reason, how well you can analyze, etc. And, you know, it is the holy grail to think about how the heck can we improve our brain power. Well, there's been some recent research that, usually solutions are hard. You go to, like in the previous interview, everything was hard, everything was complex, multivariate. But they're finding that things like walking or even standing while you're thinking is infinitely more helpful than most other things for getting stuff done. That's there are these. There's came out of Stanford research that found that meetings that are standing meetings, where people are not sitting in their chairs at the around the conference table, but they're standing, get more done. If you are thinking, if you got a problem, the conundrum that you are facing, and you are pacing, which I've now adopted, by the way, and it really works. When I have a problem that is thorny, if I don't have the time to take my lovely doggy Einstein around the Lafayette Reservoir, and where I bring a memo pad with me, and I'm thinking all the time about, I always bring a problem, but I will pace my office. I will go up and down my office, and I will think. And sometimes I will talk out loud, because talking out loud, I tend to clarify my thoughts. But think about, that's maybe the, there's no side effect of anything. There's a positive side effect of you getting a little bit of exercise. You use more calories when you're standing and walking than when you're sitting. So if you want to boost your brain power, think about walking while you're doing it. Now, caffeine, there is also good evidence that caffeine increases your IQ. And it does make sense. What does caffeine do? It increases your blood pressure slightly, and so you get better circulation of the brain, just like walking. That's why walking works, because when you are moving, there's more circulation, more oxygenation to the brain. You're therefore more likely to do better thinking. Again, while for some people, if you've got significant high blood pressure, you don't want to drink a lot of coffee. But for most people, there's a lot of evidence that coffee has all kinds of salubrious benefits, that even cancer reduction. So, that might be another way to boost your brain power without it hurting you at all. Then there's the shower. Same concept. If you go into the shower, the warm water is going to increase oxygenation to the brain. I keep a little memo pad next to my shower on a little table, and I try to bring a thorny problem that I have to solve with me into the shower, and I think about it. And again, I can't say it's not an experiment, rational scientific experiment, but I really think that I do get better solutions in the shower. Part of that, indeed, is because of the circulation of the brain that comes from the water, but of course, part of it is also there's no other distractions. So, I'm fully focused on the problem. And finally, and perhaps most mystically, there was a couple of studies that found that chewing gum increases your brain power. Why? Same circulatory answer. When you are masticating, when you're chewing gum, that is exercising muscles that are quite close to the brain, and therefore, no doubt, there's going to be some residual increased blood flow to the brain. So, there are four ways to achieve the holy grail that have no negative side effects. And by the way, the chewing gum, there's some evidence that Trident gum, which has xylitol rather than aspartame or sugar, is healthier than other gums. So not that I'm a health nut, but I figured nothing to lose. Doesn't taste bad. Trident Original is another of my. I keep a pack in my car, and I keep a pack right on my desk. And when I want to increase my brain power, and it could be just a placebo effect, but it makes me feel like I'm doing something to maximize my brain power. So those are four ways to increase your brain power with minimal risk: walking or pacing, at least standing up, caffeine, shower, and chewing gum. Anyway, that's generic advice, but I'm eager to help you. I like to think that my mission in life is to help you with your work-related problems. I've been doing this now for a long time here at KLW, and I've had 4,500 clients. So I've heard a lot, and I usually can help you at least take a baby step forward. So if you or someone you love has got a career problem, you'd like my take on the situation, the phone number here for what I call a 3-minute workover, 415-841-4134. That's the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. Another of the notes that I took that I believe are useful tips that might be useful for you career-wise. I think that the article is the new course. People used to, when they want to learn something, the first knee-jerk reflex was to go to college or go back for another degree because, you get the credibility, piece of paper, and, it's just nicely structured for you. Then, especially with the advent of MOOCs, massive online courses, people decided to take courses, individual courses either online or through the university like UC Extension or San Francisco State Extension. There were short certificate programs or courses. But even the course is too time-consuming and too much crammed information that you're not going to immediately use for most busy people. I believe in our ever-ratcheted-up internet time, the article is the new course. Because thanks to the miracle of Google, whatever it is you need to learn at that moment in time, you can instantly, for free, put it into a Google search engine and get a current article, and one of the first few search results are usually some of the best because they rank high in Google and a Google search result because it means thousands and thousands of people have backlinked to it, have read it, etc. So it seems to me that we need to replace our reflex, that when we feel we need to know more, that we're going to go back to school for a course or a certificate, let alone a degree, that we honor that free thing called the article. I'll give out the phone number one more time. If you or someone you love's got a work problem for a 3-minute career makeover, the phone number 415-841-4134. That is the number at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I wanted to make a comment regarding those four steps of increasing your brain power.
Yeah.
Instead of buying all those expensive things, you know,
right. Velocity
and all that garbage, you know.
Which would be the evidence, by the way, I attended an international conference, and there's real question about some of those activities as to whether they really create any kind of permanent change, and they are painfully annoying to do. Those exercises are really annoying, and not to mention expensive. Yes, continue.
Yes, yes, yes. So that's a great thing because what we have is what we have now. We don't have to create all these, you know, like go out and buy this for that and this for that when everything is right in front of us.
What do you mean?
Oh, to go out and buy a Lumosity.
I know that, but what's in front of us? Well, I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, everything that we need is here now. And my example is, or one of the examples you made was the walking. I mean, you don't have to go out and buy walking, right?
No.
Okay, if that makes sense. But my comment is that in the yogic traditions, in some yogic traditions, because I'm a yoga teacher, one of the things that I was taught by my master is walking thoughtfully. What you do is you pace a certain length of wherever you're at, and when you're walking, you're being very mindful of your steps. So one foot in front of the other, you know, and you keep your eyes wide open. And it does something to stimulate that the calmness and it opens up the channels for you to think.
You know what? I understand that it would increase calmness, but there are different purposes for walking. What I was talking about in terms of brain power, I'm well aware one can calm by deep breathing, by just simply yoga postures, you know, all of that. But in terms of, I believe that when you distract yourself by focusing on your steps or on your breathing or looking at you thinking of your knee as you're meditating or whatever, all of that stuff is great for calming, but not for getting stuff done. And I know that there are people who are advocates of that stuff who say that it translates into your day-to-day life and makes you more grounded and more able to learn. And I have not found that. Not only, I'm not talking about just myself, but I cannot tell you how many of my clients have taken seriously that route and have not gotten anywhere. So we're talking about, remember, you called, you're saying you were welcoming the fact you don't need to buy something in order to boost your brain power. It's in front of you. We talked about walking and caffeine and the shower and chewing gum. But I think that things like meditation may be good for calming. And indeed, before I go to bed, if I really want to go to sleep, I do monitor my breathing, and that puts me to sleep.
Yeah.
But in terms of increasing brain power, I would argue that monitoring your footstep is antithetical to increasing your brain power. Anyway, I want to thank you for the call. I don't want to get into a debate on it because I got all these lines lighted up. I want to thank you, though, for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. Hello. Hi, it's you.
How you doing?
I am well. What's on your mind?
I was thinking about a 3-minute makeover.
Sure. Tell me a little bit about your situation.
Okay, so I'm a general contractor, single dad. I'm about 46 years old, and I was listening to the earlier part of your show talking about energy and renewables.
Right.
And, you know, I deal with stuff like that in my job, mm-hmm. and... But as I'm getting older, I can feel the effects of what I do physically.
Sure, sure.
And being a general is, it's hard enough to, I can make a living, but I'm not making a ton of money, you know?
So do you want to do something radically different, or do you want to do something like find some young kid and train him to do most of the work and you be kind of the wise, you're not old, you're only 46, but the wiser, older guy?
Well, I think something more radical because I'm already in that situation. I have them puppies, and I teach them and show them. But I like I believe that energy is going to become a major industry, bigger than it is now, with renewables and solar power and all of that. And I'd like to be ahead of the curve on that. And I think that the experience I have as a contractor would benefit me, but I'm just not sure what the best approach is to try and get into that. You know?
I love being under the radar, so I would avoid the whole residential space. I've had clients, for example, who were in solar installation, and there's a million people who want to be solar installers now. I remember the government created this program to create more solar installers. By the time they recruited and trained the people, there was an oversupply of solar installers. But I think what we're talking about really here is smart grid infrastructure working for the PG&Es or the companies that build these, instead of big massive plants, these small distributed distribution plants or monitoring plants. Being a guy who builds, getting expertise in building those arcane little elements within the smart grid makes sense. Does that make sense to you?
It does. From the practical side, I can see how that would be something that I would be interested in, but the question is, where do you start?
I think you start at a conference. I think there, here in the Bay Area, there are endless expos, festivals, conferences, conventions, like at Moscone Center or whatever, where it's for the industry. It's not for the public. It's for the industry. And so if you're into alternatives, you can be sure, you can bet your life that in the next month or three, there's going to be some kind of a convention for people in the industry. And that is beautiful because every booth has people selling the latest, whatever it is, alternative techniques or machines or building processes or whatever it is for the industry. And that's how you get to meet people, talk to them. You simply tell them your story. You say, I've been a general contractor. I've got an environmental interest. I've even do a little of that work now. I'm trying to find a niche at the cutting edge of where this alternative energy is going in the business-to-business space, perhaps working for a contractor dealing with utilities, whether here or maybe even abroad. And I think if you go to all those booths and you tell your story, that you're going to find out where those under-the-radar niches are. If you just read the Chronicle or whatever, it ain't going to be there. That's going to be for the public. It's going to be a crowded market. But if you go to one of those trade shows and conferences and you visit the website for there must be a utility industry association, I don't know what it's called, but if you Google utility industry organizations, you're going to find the names of companies, you're going to find the names of conferences, and that's going to get you in. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah.
All right. Well, I thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Before I go to the phones, two things. I want to give out the phone number again. If you or someone you love wants a career makeover, 415-841-4134 is the number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. And I promised I like to intersperse the calls with tips. This is a tip I wrote recently and made a note of making sure I wanted to mention it to you. You know, we all are always trying to change somebody's mind about something, a coworker, a boss, a supervisee, or whatever. One of the better ways to do that is to explain how your idea comports with their existing beliefs. President Obama knows that he's got the liberals on his side, so whenever he makes a talk, he always frames it in terms that would appeal to conservatives. So he will say things like, it is always part of the American tradition, or it's part of the Constitution, or as the founders used to say. He will use that framing to get people who are not liberals on his side. And so you obviously are not the president, but you are equally trying to change people's minds. So always think about how the idea you're going to propose is going to comport with their beliefs. If they are a big believer in hard work, say, this will really help the workers, get more done. If the person is a big liberal, you want to talk about how it's going to be good for the collective good and how it is going to reduce our carbon footprint and take profits away from the corporations. You frame things in a way that comports with their existing beliefs. We all have certain foundational beliefs about what we think is crucial and right. Like those of you listening to the show know, I'm very critical of higher education. I think it's America's most overrated product and frankly, a much less ethical industry than we give it credit for. So if you're going to talk to me about something and you talk about how it jives with that notion, something that is you know, that is critical of the higher education industry, you're going to get much more support from me. So that's just a thought about how you might want to change people's minds. Anyway, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hi.
Marty.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
I am
well. Marty, I feel more and more like I'm a fish out of water in San Francisco. I'm a conservative, and a lot of people I speak to in San Francisco aren't conservative. They don't see things my way.
Right.
I remember you had a forum where David Victor Hansen debated this guy named, either his first name or his last name was Scott. And, hey, I really appreciate that because you got to see two really vastly different ideas and points of view. And I would like, you know, for that to come to be in San Francisco.
Forget it. No, we really are. There is a sense here in San Francisco that the left is right, and that anybody whose views are right of center really is, you know, a Neanderthal, you know, a ridiculed, you know, redneck, racist, sexist, homophobic, etc. It's that is just not a realistic thing to change, this period. There is, that's, if you feel like a fish out of water in San Francisco, you have two choices. There are tiny little quiet pockets of people who are Republicans, maybe, you know, there is something called, I'm sure, I don't know what it is exactly, I think it's maybe the Republican, just Google San Francisco Republicans or whatever, and that may get you somewhere.
But Marty, I want to be in the thick of the liberals. You know.
Okay. Well, fine. So then you've got it. You're here. But if you said okay. So what? So what's your
their points of view?
So what's your
their minds?
So good luck. You know what? That's when I was a young man. One of the things I have always been very idealistic, and I believe in the power of the word. That's why I did so much writing. That's why I talked on the radio so much. I felt like, you know, the power of the mind, the power of the marketplace of ideas would change people. I'll be 64 years old tomorrow. And as I look at my life, thank you. And as I look at my life and my really heartfelt efforts to use my best skills, which is speaking and writing, to change people's minds, I have been utterly ineffectual. Utterly ineffectual. So I have come to realize that we can't be too hubristic. We must realize, as I just said a moment ago before I spoke to you, that we have certain foundational beliefs that are incredibly difficult to change. In fact, of course, some of that is environment, but there's even finding that there is genetic differences in risk tolerance. If you are, there is genetic differences in how risk tolerant you are, and so people who have the genes for risk tolerance are more likely to be liberals. Those who want things more ordered and structured and are not willing to take lots of risk are more likely to be conservative. It is hubristic of us to think that we can triumph over, especially when we're dealing not with a child, but with an adult, that we can triumph over their genetics and their environment, and as well as the media message, which is speaking with essentially one voice, that except Fox News, which has only the tiniest mind share of, you know, the public opinion. But with all of that pressure to make people feel like liberals, we are in some sense fools to waste our time and energy trying to change people's fundamental views on that. I may be wrong, but that is one man's heartfelt opinion, having really paid a very, very, and I don't want to talk about me, but very significant price to my professional and personal life for trying to be honest about views that are not consistent with the orthodoxy of today. What's your reaction to that?
It's profound. Hey, Marty, I don't want to try to remarket you, but maybe we can just add something to your marketing. Why don't you change your title to, like, the Maserati, not the Maserati, but what was the name? Maharishi
Mahesh Yogi. Back when I was growing up, there was indeed a guru, you know, for who was in fact in favor of meditation and whatever. Anyway, is there anything else I can do to help? I wish I could be more supportive. I think you'd be wiser to find some kindred spirits. Yes, you can live in San Francisco.
You're the man.
I try my best.
You know, I tell the people about you, and I say, look, you can ask this guy any question anytime. You know, and he'll always fuel the question. Thanks, Marty. I appreciate it.
You be well. Take care. Yeah, it's of course, you heard me. It's just sigh. It saddens me that we are so ossified. You know, I've been in so many debates in my life, and in the I've done my best to be smart and yet fair and kind and whatever, and in the end, nobody changes their mind. I had a debate recently about genetically modified organisms. And the 98% of the people, what we did is before the debate started, we asked people, what's your opinion? What's your opinion about, you know, what we should do about genetically modified organisms? And, you know, most people who were in the audience were very, very much against them, where they should be labeling. And at the end of the debate, I was exactly where it was. People do not change their minds readily. And so sometimes it's best to go with the wind, not fight the wind, because otherwise you may get swept aside in the undertow. Anyway, but then again, if there weren't revolutionaries, you know, that, you know, whether it be to overthrow capitalism here in this country or to overthrow the British government in the pre-revolutionary times, we wouldn't have changed. So you're just hearing kind of a little bit of a beaten down message from a guy who's been through the wars, but we do need our radicals. I do want to say that, actually. You know, there's a tendency to try to deify the moderate. You know, the show that precedes this, the philosophy talk, talks about the golden mean and moderation and whatever. But sometimes I think that the wisest decisions come from the experiencing of extremes as well as the moderates. Extremes on the extreme right. I was watching, and I'm not a communist, I'm really not, but I was watching C-SPAN, and they were covering the American Communist Party's convention. And although I was very, very busy, I watched it for 20 minutes because I was really eager to hear what the people from the far left have to say. And I'm equally eager to hear what the far right has to say. There's a guy named Jared Taylor who runs something called American Renaissance, far right. And many would call him racist. And yet I like reading and hearing what he has to say. And I like hearing from moderates because they also have something to say. But I think we do not pay the necessary respect to the full length of the continuum. Of course, somebody who's malevolent, as in the previous show in philosophy talk, they're talking about Hitler. No, we don't listen to him. But there are benevolently derived people with smart, interesting things to say. He mentioned Victor Davis Hanson. Victor Davis Hanson is a conservative and a smart one. And there are really great liberals who I also love to listen to, like Christopher Hitchens when he was alive. But I think we must pull on ropes of restraint when we hear views that are discordant with who we are and really listen. Not to stupid people. There are not everybody's smart, but to smart people who are well-intentioned, whether they come from the left or the right or the center, they truly deserve listening to if we really care about diversity, if we really care about open-mindedness, if we really care about creating a better society for everyone. And I can't think of a better way to end the show than that. That is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will devote the entire hour to you. Please, you call in for a 3-minute workover, and I'll intersperse those with my favorite new career-related ideas. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.